Today, we begin our conversations with the candidates. Today, we sit down with Tom Keese, who's the Republican candidate for the state Senate Plymouth and Barnstable seat. We'll be sitting down with his Democratic opponent, Therese Murray, on November 1st. And you can find all our conversations and debates on our website, capeandislands.org. Welcome.
Good morning, Mindy. Thanks for having me.
Tell us why you're running for state Senate. Why do you want this job?
Well, you know, this has been a three-year journey. I ran in 2010. And here I am, Tom Keese, 12 years of regional and local political experience. I ran against the Senate president. And everyone said, good for you. Well, we showed that the district was looking for the message that I was bringing forward. And we received 48% of the vote. We were the closest race in the entire state. And I couldn't walk away from 48. So here I am again, knocking on every door from Pembroke to Falmouth, probably to the horror of my wife. But when you get 48% of the vote, we basically split the district. I couldn't walk away from it. Mm-hmm. And again, I've been involved for the past 14 years in local and regional civics and policy and politics. And I just think I have the right message at the right time for this district.
So if you were to be elected, what would be your top priority?
Well, there's two big ones that I'm running on. And it's not so much that these are just issues of the day. A lot of it has to do with my background. First and foremost, jobs. We have a real problem here in Massachusetts. And it was about a month and a half ago, I proposed in front of the T-ticket market at a press conference what we're calling the Small Business Bill of Rights. Businesses in Massachusetts are having a real problem with just an abundance of overregulation that's changing constantly. And they have a hard time having the right resources in the front office to manage what the state's requiring of them. You know, most businesses are under 25 employees, so you can't have a full-time human resource department, and it becomes really problematic. And so when we put together the Small Business Bill of Rights, the first and foremost is we want to put a moratorium on adding more deliverables to our health insurance programs. Health insurance is very expensive. It's the most expensive in the entire nation. And we just want to put a moratorium together so that we're not adding more and more deliverables. It's very expensive. And what's happening in business right now, on the private side, it's more like a 60-40 or a 50-50 split where employees have to cover half of the cost. And when the double-digit increase to that line item, which is health insurance, comes in, instead of an employee getting a raise, the employers are saying, we're going to cover your increase on the health insurance. And this has been going on for a few years in a row. And so I'll talk to employees and employers where they haven't been able to give out raises for a few years, but the cost has still been going up and the employee's share hasn't gone up. But the employees aren't looking at that as much because they just see that they haven't received a raise for a few years. Mm-hmm. And morale is down and, you know, people are shifting from one industry to another. But, you know, I've had my own practice for 14 years. I own a small business. I'm a management consultant. I'm a business coach. I go into these companies and I help them get through all of their regulations and make it so that a company can peel back that onion, those layers of burden on top of burden. And when you start peeling back those layers, they become profitable again. And they have an opportunity to give raises or maybe do some hiring or expand the business. We are overregulated. So jobs in the economy is number one. But number two, it's restore integrity back to the legislative process. I'm also an ethics and compliance officer. I do this through my practice. I go into companies and I put together a code of ethical conduct and I help them become good corporate citizens. Or if there was an infraction in the company and through the courts, I've been installed to, again, put together a code of ethical conduct. I will write it. I will train on it. I will audit. And then I'll take corrective action if necessary. But when you do that and there's no more retaliation, there's no more favoritism going on, there's no kickbacks, there's all kinds of things that will erode that corporate culture. And people, when they work within a company where this is going on, that culture trickles down where people don't really enjoy the whole experience of working for this company. The morale goes up, productivity goes up. And then, although you're looking at this, the code of ethical conduct, it's actually very good for productivity and retaining employees. I want to bring that to Beacon Hill because we've had a lot of problems lately with this ongoing indictment problem with the probation department, which is still ongoing. We have the FBI, as well as U.S. District Attorney. They're continuing with taking testimony from elected officials out in Worcester on this probation scandal. They've this has to end. We've had three speakers in a row get indicted. We have three senators over the last few years gone to jail. We need to bring integrity back to the process. And as an ethics and compliance officer, I've actually proposed again, once I'm successful, to a plan to restore integrity back to the legislative process. And it's a 13-point plan.
All right, you got a couple things here that are racing through my mind as you're talking.
Yes.
Let's go back to the healthcare for a second. The cost containment bill. What are your specific? I mean, how do you? A lot of legislators would like to get, you know, do something about that cost factor. That's where we're sort of focusing now. So, do you have a specific plan there? Are you liking a plan that somebody else is proposing? How would you, you know, work with other legislators up there, which would have to be bipartisan, obviously?
Yes.
How would you work to get whatever your plan is done? And is it your plan or somebody else's?
The healthcare. Let's talk about what just got passed up on Beacon Hill. The governor just signed on August 1st this new bill. But that same week, Standard & Poor came out and degraded our entire medical infrastructure because of it. They're calling it a bad bill. And it's a bad bill because in this new healthcare containment plan, there's a $40 million agency that's now been created that actually is being headed by my opponent's top aide, who wrote the bill. We have entire medical legal infrastructure. It's actually there's a staff. I can't remember which hospital right now, but there's one that came out that said they can't make sense of this bill. And we also have Standard & Poor's that same week that it was signed into law, they've downgraded the entire value of our medical infrastructure because hospitals are no longer in control of their destiny.
So you don't like this bill. So what do you like? What would you propose if you were up there? What would you do?
To help control costs.
Yes, to help control costs.
One of the biggest things we have to do is look. Healthcare has been completely removed from our system of deliverables, which is at the free market. If you go to get, say, an MRI, you don't know what it costs. You can't shop around. And there literally are swings of about 500% for the exact same procedure happening from one facility to another. If we knew there was a 500% increase at another facility, as consumers, we can go somewhere else. That competition will allow for the entire system to be in control. We don't know what the pills cost, we don't know any of that. And that's a real problem. Now, this bill that just came out of the Senate and the legislature and signed by the governor, they're talking about that. But we need the hospitals. What we need to do is we need to get it so that the hospitals are actually making this data available. Instead of creating a $40 million agency to oversee the medical infrastructure, instead of doing that, we should just make it so that the hospitals must produce this data. I'm not saying every time someone goes in, we need to know what that cost. What I'm saying is maybe quarterly or monthly that it's broadcast what these deliverables are costing so that we as consumers can make wise choices and that so that they as the providers, they understand that everyone's watching and that they have to be accountable. Without accountability, things go wrong. Again, that goes into my whole background of ethics and compliance. But we need to make sure that people are accountable. If everything's done in secret, we get 500% swings on deliverables.
We're talking with Tom Keyes, a Republican candidate for the State Senate Plymouth and Barnstable seat. Our toll-free number, if you have a question for the candidate this morning, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. You mentioned jobs, so I'm going to go back there for a second now. What is your plan or thoughts on jobs beyond service industry and tourism?
You mean specific for Cape Cod?
Yeah, specific to this region. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, because the district that I'm running
right,
in is
Plymouth
Plymouth. Yep. I'm half in Plymouth County, half in Barnstable County. We need to make it so that businesses feel that the legislature is a partner in the process and they're not being treated like the golden goose. If we just allow businesses to have a little more breathing room, they'll come here. I mean, think about this scenario. Over the last 20 years, we've lost a third of all of our corporate offices in the state of Massachusetts. That's a real problem. We've also lost an entire congressional seat worth of people. We call them economic refugees. They've chased their industries. They've gone to, and again, these industries didn't go to China and India like we keep hearing about. They went to Rhode Island and New Hampshire and the Carolinas and the Midwest. And they need to be here, but they can't. And the reason they're not here, even Fidelity left, and they don't even produce anything, because they cannot survive in this atmosphere, this climate that's been created of overregulation and corporate burden of taxation. I'm not saying that we should be the cheapest. I'm saying let's be competitive. Think about this. If Massachusetts, if we looked at our, let's call it the total burden to business, no matter whether it be regulation, taxation, whatever it is, if we became competitive with states that are in our region, or even Carolinas in the Midwest, businesses would come here. We wouldn't have to attract them, because the one thing we have is we have the best trained employees. Our productivity rate is through the roof. It's the greatest in the nation. Businesses would love to be here. We have our institutions of higher learning. We have our medical infrastructure. We have research and development. We're a polytech. You can go on and on. We have the ideas. We have the skilled workforce, but they won't be here because they can't make a profit, or their profits are that much less. So let's be competitive. They'll come here. We won't have to attract them. We've already forced them out. My opponent's already talking about we need to bring in new bio, life sciences, all these new industries. Stop thinking about bringing in new industries. Let's support the ones that are here. She already has constituents here that are in industries that are looking to leave. We need to keep them here.
So you don't think we should be trying to attract new industry, bioservices?
Certainly should.
Okay.
The problem is that we're how do we attract a new industry to Massachusetts when we have the highest cost of health insurance? We have the highest cost of unemployment insurance. What are we, the third highest in utility cost? How does a company want to come here? Well, we attract them. How? By giving them incentive. So if we give a business an incentive, which would be a tax increment financing or all kinds of opportunities, whether we create the infrastructure for them, they're going to come here because we gave them something. Well, why don't we not give them something? Why don't we take care of the businesses that are here? And if we reduce that burden, they will expand, they will grow, they will hire, and we won't have to attract, because eventually that subsidy that we're giving to these new industries is going to run out. And now that favored status is going to run out. That's why Fidelity left. Their favored status ran out, and so did they.
Let's talk about something that's been in the news recently, last couple of days, is the federal government's rejection of the casino compact between Governor Patrick and the Mashpee Wampanoag. And one of the reasons in there was it had to do with that 21.5% of the revenue. Commercial casinos are being asked to pay 25% of gross gaming revenues. So what are your thoughts here going forward? Would you support that going less than 21.5% when the commercial casinos are going to have to do 25%? What are your thoughts?
Oh, that's interesting. 21 is less than what we see in other casinos, but it's a very complicated issue, because if you go just cross our borders and you're looking at what's happening down in Connecticut, they're not making money. They're flat. Actually, some say they're underwater, but at best they're flat. So they're not making money. So do we want to put together facilities that aren't working, that aren't going to survive? Because one other problem we have is when we put these casinos here in Massachusetts, there's now more competition. And so right now, a lot of people in Massachusetts are going to Connecticut for their gaming. If it's here, then they won't have to. But the problem is now Connecticut's going to have a real problem. They've lost a lot of foot traffic. And our casinos aren't going to be able to attract the foot traffic that they have down in Connecticut, because obviously they're not going to come here. So when we're looking at 25% is causing others to fail, and we're at 21%, I think the Wampanoags actually have a very good point. If too much is going to the state, then are they going to be able to make a profit and survive as an entity? It's a great argument. Mm-hmm. Everything comes down to negotiations. But I think they've got a very good point saying 21% might cause them to fail. And we got to make sure if we're going to build something, we got to make sure that it's not going to fail.
Yeah, because there were some other issues as well that they had with that. It wasn't just that. There was some other, you know, exclusivity rights and other things about that. So what are your thoughts going forward on the casinos? Do you agree with the governor saying that, you know, giving the Mashpee Wampanoag sort of this preferential status for that southeastern casino?
I think the Wampanoag should absolutely have a preferential status. But I'm concerned that if we put too many casinos in, that we're just going to water it down. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the casinos in Connecticut are already having a hard time surviving, and then we build, what we're talking about, three regionally, that's concerning to me. Because we're going to put in an awful lot of infrastructure that's going to be built by the state. Because there's going to be a lot of roadway infrastructure that's going to have to happen. There's going to be a lot of expense here. And if it fails, then all we did was we created something that really the market wasn't asking for. And again, we got to make sure the market's looking for what we're building.
We're talking with Tom Keyes, Republican candidate for the State Senate Plymouth and Barnstable District. Our toll-free number, if you have a question for the candidate, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@wgbh.org. I'm going to get back to the issues in a second, but I want to talk a little about your campaigning first. I think you said you've knocked on 8,000 doors.
Just over 8,000.
Yeah. And you said something interesting to me before you went on the air. You talked about the summer when you're knocking on doors in the summer, and generally people they're not connected. They're like not thinking of the campaign. And you said that was different this year. Now, you've been doing this for 3 years. So tell me what you're finding as you're going out and knocking on people's doors.
Yeah, this is my third year in this campaign, you know, running and getting 48% last time. But I've been involved in a lot of politics over the last 14 years. And the summertime for campaigns is the doldrums of the summer because everyone's at the beach. No one's paying attention. And people, last thing they want is someone knocking on their door talking about politics. But it changed this year, and I was very surprised to see this. It's a heightened alert by everybody. We again, knocking on 8,000 doors and going to people where they even have parties going on in their backyards at their pools, and they'll call me over. And I'm not there to interrupt, you know, people having a good time, but they've called me over. There was a great big band going on in the backyard. They called me back, and they handed me the microphone to talk about politics. I said, I know you said, please, this is not why I'm here. But people are paying attention this year. They're paying attention to the national, and they're paying attention to the state. And I was a little taken aback by that. Mm-hmm. It's great to see, because let me tell you, when you're pounding the pavement, and it's 90-something degrees.
You surprised me with that, because I wasn't expecting to hear that either. But let's talk a little about, you know, your experience. What skills and experience do you think that you bring to this job?
Yeah. Again, you know, being a former selectman for a couple of terms, being on the county level for a couple of terms. Also, I was the former president of the Selectmen and Councilors Association, and I was on their board of directors for 6 years. So I have, and then all kinds of other boards and committees, a cemetery commissioner, a water quality review committee, economic development for 10 years. That's a lot of it, local and regional experience where I have a good understanding for the district. And you tie that with my small business where I'm a business coach and management consultant, and I'm an efficiency guy. That's really what I do. I do efficiencies. I get companies certified to international and national standards. And it's about standardizing and understanding and predicting where we can go, either as a municipality, as an organization, or as a state. That's the one thing that misses the mark time and time again, is the predictability. Because with frugality and predictability, you can do a moonshot. You can do anything. But sometimes government doesn't look past lunch. We need to look multi-years out. When we make or we take a vote on anything, we need to look at what's the impact 5 years out. Because although this year, this is a great initiative, this initiative is most likely going to grow in cost over the next few years. And what's it going to bump? And that's really important. In the town of Sandwich, I put together the long-range plan. I was very proud of that. And before that, we never had anything that was looking multi-years out. And this is 5 years out, and then with the 10-year look. And in 2005, we said when we had to go for an override, this is going to last 3 years. Here we are, 2012, and we still don't need an override. Because the long-range plan, it smoothed out the way departments were requesting capital needs, because they saw and had predictability of when is a better time to actually request these needs instead of everyone asking every year, which turns into $4 million requests when you have $400,000 in dollars. It's It's allowed for predictability. And I do that for companies and organizations, and I've done it for a municipality. So I bring, I guess, that skill.
Mm-hmm.
But also, again, in the world of ethics and compliance, we must have transparency in everything we do. When the legislature right now, they've given themselves an exemption from the open meeting law. Your board of selectmen, your council on aging board, your planning board, everyone's subject to the open meeting law so that the public can view their work being done before them. But more important than that, the media, the press, yourself, you have an opportunity to be our eyes and ears of what's going on, because the public is busy and they can't watch. But you can't watch. The press can't watch. Everything happens in the Senate on what's called Room 348. And although my opponent likes to say, well, everything in the rostrum is on live streaming, it's all done in Room 348, and the press has never been in there, and the public's never been in there. That's where all the debate and negotiations happen. They just come out to take a vote, and someone says, well, what happened? In the last budget bill, there was 188 amendments that were bundled into one voice vote. Nobody knew what was in it. So that's a problem. And then you look at my grandmother always said, sunlight's your best disinfectant. Let's bring some light to the process up there. The legislature should not be exempt from the open meeting law, because everybody else is subject to it, as well as even the fair procurement. You know, you have to put out to bid whenever you want to buy something or do something as a municipality. The legislature is exempt. And then third, the freedom of information. You know, we can get the courts to petition their internal documents. Legislature, again, is exempt. This is not how we should be running a democracy.
Let me ask you, we got a lot of issues that we're probably not going to have time for, but let's talk about wastewater management, which is a huge issue here on the Cape. Thoughts on, you know, this is going to be a very pricey thing, and I know that the entire Cape is not your district, but part of the Cape is, and we've got towns at different levels, so to speak, of dealing with this issue. Federal funding doesn't look like it's going to be very much there. So, no. So what are you thinking? How are we going to pay for this?
I've been working on this for a long time, and I was a former chair of the Water Quality Review Committee. There's a few things that we need to do. Dr. Brian House, who heads up the estuaries program, in 2004, we had a meeting in Chatham, and there are a lot of low-cost things that we can do now. And we're kind of putting the cart before the horse here. If we take care of all of the low-cost solutions, then we can get our nitrates down to a manageable number. Then we might not have to go with this large pipe solution that a lot of people are screaming about right now. For instance, he said one of the biggest things we can do is creative dredging. You know, our estuaries have all silted in over time. We do have a county dredge. They're relatively cheap and very effective. But he put it this way, where the nitrates, which is just food for the most part, whether it be from human waste or fertilizers or road runoff, when it gets into our large estuaries, our salt marshes, and the tide comes up and the ocean water flows in, it pushes those nitrates to the backside. But then when the tide goes out, the water inside doesn't have the same pressure to force it all out. And over time, we've now allowed a lot of our marshes at the mouth, at the opening, to silt in a bit. So it's not all coming out. And then the tide will come back and start pushing back in. So that pocket of nitrates never got a chance to flush appropriately. He said if we just put in dredging, which you'll never see, you just go in, make channels. Everyone's done that when they went to the beach with their kids. You know, you dredge something so the tide can come in. He said it's as simple as that. If we had better flow, then the nitrates would move and we'd have an opportunity to remove a lot of that. But second is we put in those new culverts so that road runoff isn't going into our estuaries. And third, we have to take care of our fertilizer problem. We're over-fertilizing and we can use more natural fertilizers. But there's a whole list of low-cost things we can do. And he said if we get our nitrate loads removed by somewhere between 10 and 20%, we could have a positive reclamation of all of our embayments just by doing that. So that's really important. So if we go there, and let's say we would reduce our nitrates by 10 to 20%, and our algae plumes start to diminish or reduce or even maybe eliminate in some places, then this threat of a $60,000 to $100,000 betterment per household now goes away. And although I'm sure we're going to have to do it in some areas.
That's what I was going to say, because you've got a lot of people who are living on those waters. Yeah.
But there are still some areas going to have to be done. But now we won't have to do it as much. And we can do regional solutions as opposed to large solutions. Mm-hmm. Because the large one's not going to happen. It's very, very expensive.
Yeah, and when you that's another question. We have the regional versus town. As I said, towns are at different levels as far as the process goes. But water is a regional issue.
Very much so.
And there's probably more money available on a regional issue than if you're going it town by town, right?
One would hope, but we haven't found this money anywhere. The federal dollars that were there back in the late 80s aren't there, and we missed that bus.
Yeah. We got about a minute and a half left, and I know there's a lot of issues that we didn't touch on. So
I could stay for another hour.
I don't think the Diane Rehm fans would be happy to preempt her show. But if you could just sort of touch upon maybe like a closing statement, some of the issues maybe we didn't touch on, where you stand and why you think you're the best candidate.
Well, first, there's a lot going on in this campaign. It's going well. We're doing well in the press. We're doing well on the radio. We're doing well on our feet. Again, we've put out over 60,000 pieces. I've knocked on just over 8,000 doors. We've been running this race for 3 years. And my experience as pretty much selectman, county, law, I understand the district intimately. I know what we're looking for. But also, if you look at just today, the Cape Cod Times My View, I just received the endorsement of former U.S. District Attorney Michael Sullivan. It's great. He agrees with me in this whole lack of transparency up in the legislature. We need to bring integrity back to the legislative process. And without shining a light on it, we're not going to see it because they're not doing it themselves. Another big point is, I received the endorsement of a gentleman named Neil Anderson. These wind turbines, this issue is a hotbed issue. And those individuals that are aggrieved, they need to be made whole. We need to do something there. It's happening now in Kingston. It's now happening in Plymouth. This district is ground zero for wind needs. And so we need to make sure that we're not infringing on people's personal private property rights. We can have our cake and eat it too, but we got to do it right. And last, if I can just say, we're having a great event on Sunday. It's at the Aqua Grill. We call it our annual Oktoberfest. Again, Michael Sullivan's going to come down and speak. I'd love to have you there. I'd love everyone to come. Again, that's at the Aqua Grill this Sunday.
All right. Tom Keyes, Republican candidate for the State Senate, Plymouth and Barnstable District seat, will be sitting down with his Democratic opponent, Therese Murray, on November 1st. You can find all of our conversations and debates on our website, capeandislands.org. We'll also have links to the candidates' websites. Thanks for being here.
Thank
I'm
you.
Indy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point airs weekdays at 9:30 a.m. and 7:30 p.m. We're also on Facebook at The Point WCAI. The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Dan Treidle and Jenny Junker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR station, a service of WGBH.